Hi and welcome. My name is Hadassah Drukash. I'm your host, and this is the Law of Tech podcast. Digital technologies are disrupting and transforming the law and legal industry at an unprecedented speed and, in until recently, unimaginable ways. And this is just the beginning. The question is, how do we prepare the legal world of tomorrow? In this podcast, I interview experts across the industry and beyond and speak to leaders in law who are thinking outside the box and questioning the status quo. Together with them, I will delve deeper into some of the pressing questions, topics, and issues at the intersection of law and digital technologies that are shaping and reshaping the law as we know it and guiding the legal profession towards the future. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Law of Tech podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking more about the impact of automated gender recognition systems. And for this, I am joined by my wonderful and inspiring colleague, Dr. Eduard Fuchs-Villaronga. Eduard is currently an assistant professor at the ELaw Center for Law and Digital Technologies at Leiden University, where he investigates legal and regulatory aspects of robot and AI technologies, with a special focus on healthcare. In addition, he's currently serving the European Commission in the subgroup on artificial intelligence, connected products, and other new challenges in product safety to the Consumer Safety Network to revise the General Product Safety Directive. Previously, he worked as a Marie Curie postdoctoral researcher under the leading fellows at ELaw. He also was a postdoc at the Microsoft Cloud Computing Research Center at Queen Mary University, London, investigating the legal implications of cloud robotics, and at the University of Twente as a postdoc, exploring iterative regulatory modes for robot governance. The resulting work from his time in Twente has formed the basis for the Liaison Research Project to which he is the PI, and which aims to link robot and policymaking to reduce the complexity in robot legal compliance. Furthermore, Eduard is a qualified lawyer in Spain and he holds an Erasmus Mundus joint doctorate in law, science and technology coordinated by the University of Bologna, an LLM from the University of Toulouse, an MA from the Autonomous University of Madrid, and an LLB from the Autonomous University of Barcelona. Eduard, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Now, developments in artificial intelligence entail incredible progress for many fields in the near future. AI is increasingly influencing the opinions and behavior of people in everyday life, and it is no longer merely confined to industry, but can be found in many other fields such as, for example, healthcare, education, and retail environments. Nevertheless, the introduction and implementation of AI in society raises a variety of ethical, legal, and societal concerns, and within this context, there are still many, many areas in which there is substantial room for improvement. One of the areas in which there is room for such improvement is that of diversity and inclusion. Now, to really kick off this episode and taking into account its topic, can you give us a brief insight into the diversity and inclusion gap that we are currently encountering in AI?
The implications and deep-rootedness of gender and diversity considerations in practices and structural systems have been largely disregarded in the development of algorithms. For instance, automated gender recognition systems clash with the idea that gender is subjective and internal, often leading to misgendering outcomes that may have ulterior adverse effects for large parts of the population, including the transgender, intersex, and non-binary community. Questions around the consequences of missing the gender and sex dimension in algorithms for society are particularly poorly understood and often underestimated. In general, and in particular, in decisions that affect our lives significantly. And in this respect, the global landscape of AI ethics guidelines do not really seem to provide adequate guidance in addressing the potential implications of missing gender and inclusivity considerations in AI development, although this may significantly impact society. So there are different communities that they are focusing on this topic, But the investigation is very much scattered and little compared to other research strains that focus on safety or data protection. And it is also often unclear how this research informs global governance efforts that aim to frame these rapid developments adequately. So part of my work tries to step forward in bridging this gap by exploring how current algorithmic-based systems may reinforce gender biases and affect marginalized communities. And to do so, I usually work in collaboration with excellent researchers from different disciplines, bringing together notions and reflections from computer science, queer media studies, and legal insights to better understand the magnitude of failing to consider gender and sex difference in the use of algorithms.
Now, you've already elaborated on this point, and you just mentioned that a more specific practical example of this gap can be found in the fact that algorithms do not always account for gender and sex considerations, and this may have detrimental impacts on the lives of individuals and may even lead to discrimination. Now, in order to understand exactly how this works, and before delving deeper into potential consequences, legal implications, and solutions, we perhaps ought to take a step back and first take a more focused look at the concepts of gender and sex. Zooming in on these concepts, many definitions and explanations have been attributed to them, depending on the context and culture in which they are used. Looking at all the information and knowledge that we have gained so far, how can these concepts best be understood and how has that changed over time?
Scientific research is increasingly taking gender and sex into account because it makes better science. However, queer media studies stresses that sex, gender, and sexuality are often confused and used in overlapping ways by both lay people and experts. And a good way to start is to look at the gender-bred person, which is a teaching tool for breaking the big concept of gender down into bite-sized, digestible pieces. And there you can understand that there are many different concepts interrelated, including gender, attraction, sex, and expression. Sex usually refers to the assigned gender at birth based on medical factors, genitalia, chromosomes, and hormones. And it's usually male or female, and in some cases, it's intersex. This sex is changeable through medical gender transition. Gender, on the contrary, is both a person's internal deeply held sense of their gender, also called gender identity, whereas sexuality, it may be more the physical, romantic, and emotional attraction that one person has for another one. These definitions are socially constructed through societal demands and norms, and obviously modern society also challenges the interplay between these definitions. In the integrated relations between sex, gender, and sexuality, there are multiplicities of understanding, accepting, legalizing, and including diverse societal groups by both the nations and also the companies and organizations. And this is also true for social media, digital platforms, and actually how gender is used in and through algorithms, of which automated gender recognition systems are one example. It is of crucial importance.
So really we're talking about, on the one hand, very objective concepts, and on the other hand, very subjective concepts that really differ based on, for example, biological factors or elements such as identity.
Yes, that it can differ.
Now, linking to this, some especially feminist scholars have argued that technology has for too long been part of a distinct male sphere. As a result, the criteria used nowadays to develop new technologies may reflect the technology biases that existed in another time and that really should no longer be valid. What factors mediate the development of technology in this direction, and how has the male power and interest played a role within this context?
Yeah, so if you look at how technology is being made and used by male power and interest, you can clearly see how technology reflects biases. For instance, by incorporating breasts to robotic nurses or using female voices for caring applications. Although not very explicit, these biases may reinforce existing ideals that can be very influential in exacerbating discrimination. And the problem lies in the problem of siloed environments, which are oblivious to what happens outside of those environments. If you are not inclusive and you do not account for diversity, it is definitely going to cause a lot of problems. if the perspectives of women, the queer community, and other communities are not considered in robot and AI development, implicit biases will persist. Moreover, these communities will remain mostly invisible, silent, powerless, and unable to understand how these technologies may affect them. Users of technology produce an extensive entanglement of social constructions, relationships, and practices. And they consume, modify, domesticate, design, reconfigure, and even resist to technological development. And in this sense, when framing technology within the traditional heteronormativity, one risks exclusion, as configuring the user as everybody can make technology work for the majority while dramatically excluding various minorities.
Now, in order to prevent such inherently human biases, over the centuries, humans developed critical theory to inform decisions and avoid basing them solely on personal experience. However, machine intelligence learns primarily from observing data that it is presented with, thereby diverting from this theory. While machines are increasingly capable of processing large volumes of data, if that data is laden with stereotypical concepts of, for example, gender, it is believed, and this has also become a growing global concern, that the resulting application of the technology may perpetuate, exacerbate, and reinforce existing biases that different societies have with respect to, for example, gender, age, race, and sexual orientation. Now, you've already touched upon this topic, but looking more closely at gendering algorithms, how do they exactly work, and can you give us an insight into how they may end up including biases or exacerbating already existing gender stereotypes?
So if you remember the different definitions that I gave you right now, from a computer science perspective, automated gender recognition systems usually take sex as a basic point of reference, and it has been used to boost applications in face recognition and also in text recognition. So to infer gender, therefore, gender classification systems make use of gender stereotype features such as body movements, physiological and behavioral characteristics, facial features, and language use to fit newly observed features in inputted data such as gait, hand shape, or sentiment into either a masculine or a feminine category using such trained classifier. Let's take, for instance, the example of text-based gender classifier systems. These systems infer gender using features such as language, vocabulary, and frequency of words. And also, they use these from content that is found in emails, blogs, forums, or social media. And beyond language, there are other text-based feature extractions in the typography field, being able to train a classifier that is trying to make gender inferences based, for instance, on style markers, structural characteristics, or gender preferential language. Classifiers trained on real-world datasets are often biased because the data used to train them is biased, containing namely racial and gender stereotypes. So for instance, female names are more associated with family than career words, or with arts more than mathematics or science. And there are authors that report that the verb cooking was found to be more heavily biased towards females rather than toward males. And the same gender biases have been shown also in natural language processing, which is another method used to support gender classifiers. So these gender biases in the offline world may propagate to artificial intelligence if not addressed carefully. And this is particularly worrisome if we understand that individuals perceive automatic misgendering as more harmful than human misgendering.
That is definitely a very worrisome development, and besides only adopting and possibly exacerbating existing biases, as the volume of available data increases, AI technologies are also increasingly capable of recognizing and inferring certain human characteristics, such as, for example, gender, and linking them to individuals. Now, focusing on those gender inferences, why do companies use these systems, and what does the law say about this?
So, Online and social media platform providers use attributes of their users, including their name, age, and gender, to improve user experience and online behavioral advertising. So for instance, the social media platform, Twitter, infers gender from a wide variety of sources. And by processing these user attributes, companies can target or exclude certain groups more easily, tailor their services to users, and increase their attention levels. In this way, somehow, profiling makes marketing much more precise and effective. However, a growing concern is the increasing use of opaque inferential analytics that reveal these sensitive user traits that serve the attention economics. So one bias is gender stereotyping, which refers to the practice of ascribing to an individual, a woman or a man, specific attributes, characteristics, or roles that had been traditionally been conceived by only the mere reason of her or his membership in a societal group of women or men. However, gender stereotyping is a complex process that, although based on strong beliefs of what gender is and what gender should be, it is often understood too simplistically. For instance, there are some researchers that investigated how television character perceptions often judge effeminate gay men negatively. They also found out that straight acting or hypermasculine gay men are evaluated more favorably for conforming to an even mastering heteronormative gender roles. And these researchers also highlight that gay men who are perceived to be more feminine would map onto traditional female stereotypes. So the relationship with this, with the law, is that two international human rights treaties include explicit obligations relating to harmful and wrongful stereotyping, mainly the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women and the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So usually states are the recipients of human rights treaties, but the United Nations Human Rights Council has shown growing attention to the responsibility that corporations, sectors, and industries worldwide have for respecting human rights. Still, these stereotypes persist both online and offline, as if platforms somehow fail to understand that gender is not merely being a man or a woman, but it is actually a social construct.
And this also really indicates that the ways in which such companies and platforms operate really clashes with the distinction that you made at the beginning between, on the one hand, sex, and on the other hand, gender. Gender being something that you choose and not something that is assigned to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, based on this, I think we can safely conclude that gender stereotyping is a very complex process that vastly differs among countries, and that, although based on strong beliefs of what gender is and should be, is both used and understood too simplistically, something you already mentioned and highlighted before. Now, more generally, looking at the working of such gender inferring or recognizing and bias exacerbating algorithms, what are some of the broader impacts they may have? I know you already mentioned some of the broader impacts, but besides those, what are some of the other broader impacts these algorithms may have?
Sure. So misgendering users via these systems, via automated gender recognition systems, have also broader adverse implications, some of them being directly the idea that this might reinforce gender binarism, so the idea that there's only two types of gender, female and male. It may also undermine autonomy, be a tool for surveillance, and threaten safety. And these aspects are very important because once you infer this gender without giving the possibility to people to really express which is their preferred gender, then you're completely undermining their autonomy and their freedom of decision. And in particular, misgendering is problematic for those communities that have been historically discriminated, like, for instance, the transgender community. And for them, gender is a very sensitive part of their identity. And somehow, misgendering reinforces the idea that society does not consider a person's gender real. It may cause rejection, and this may really impact self-esteem and confidence. Somehow the felt authenticity of a person and the idea that you are actually being socially stigmatized. So when the tools also at the same time, they extract these patterns and profiles from data and you do not know exactly which type of data they are being used in order to infer these sensitive traits, it might be very hard for the user to really contend any decision that results from these. And this might really impede their freedom and autonomy. And on the top of that, if sensitive attributes such as sexual orientation, ethnicity, or religion are used for decision making, this may result in discrimination also from the legal perspective.
Yes, and this legal perspective is also something I would love to turn to next, because that algorithms exacerbate existing biases, such as, for example, gender biases, and affect marginalized communities is not new at all. Nevertheless, it never fails to shock me. However, rapid technological advancements do give rise to growing concerns with regard to the discriminatory outcomes and potentially adverse effects that gendered algorithms and misgendering may have for large parts of the population. Now, within this context, and also taking into account that this podcast is obviously about the legal implications of new technologies, where does the law, or perhaps also ethics, come into play, and what law is applicable? Now, I know that you already gave part of the legal framework, but what is the full picture of the legal framework that we're looking at here?
So when the tools used to extract patterns and profiles from data that they are not transparent, it may be hard for people to contend any decisions, no, resulting from this, and this might impede their freedom and autonomy. This is something I just said. But on the top of that, in the European Union, the collecting of and processing of personal data is protected under the General Data Protection Regulation, which also addresses somehow discrimination issues in data sets. However, there are some scholars, mainly Sandra Wachter and Brent Mittelstadt, that know that the information about a person's gender, age, or financial situation, geolocation, and online profiles are not sensitive data, according to Article 9 of the GDPR, despite often being grounds for discrimination. And this is something very interesting because in the GDPR, we do protect certain types of data that we call sensitive data in a more comprehensive way than other types of data. But gender, for instance, it is not considered such an important data, even if for, as I just mentioned in the podcast, for some communities, this is really crucial and this is really part of their identity. And when it comes to discrimination, this discrimination can be direct or indirect. When dealing with discrimination in patterns and profiles extracted from large data sets, proxy discrimination can be hard to detect. So indirect discrimination can occur unintentionally when profile users are unaware of any harm they may be doing. However, However, it might be also the case that companies use profiles precisely to conceal discrimination, which is referred to as masking. And because direct discrimination in data is hard to detect and indirect discrimination is even harder to detect, it can be really difficult to enforce equal treatment and data protection legislation. And in this respect, many forms of discrimination are illegal in most Western jurisdictions. For instance, when hiring a person is based on their gender or their ethnicity, or at least controversial, no? So for instance, when not hiring someone because they have a criminal record. And legislation that bans discrimination on the grounds of specific characteristics concerns, on the one hand, lists characteristics that may not serve as a basis for making decisions, including gender, ethnicity, political preferences, trade union membership, or sexual orientation. And on the other hand, certain types of decisions are forbidden, such as hiring and firing employees or offering products and services. Now, not every decision based on sensitive characteristics is forbidden, however. For example, it is a matter of a personal choice who your friends are on a social media platform, for instance. Nonetheless, it may occur that there is some weaker form of discrimination, that it is based on the information that your friendships in a social network provide in the form of stigmatization of a specific population or group. And on a larger scale, this could even lead to social polarization and segregation. So for now, using wrong pronouns or misgendering someone is not sufficiently grave, is not sufficiently demeaning to be considered harassment under certain specific legal provisions, although several parts of the population may advocate for remedies that make justice to these acts.
Now, this seems to indicate that the practices that we're talking about really aren't grave enough to actually trigger the legal provisions that may be applicable. And as a result, I can't help but question whether the legal framework that we have in place really provides sufficient protection against these practices, and whether we should perhaps opt for some sort of change in this legal framework to actually provide the protection that is necessary and that isn't there at the moment.
I think that right now there is not that much clarity until what extent this is harmful to society. So I may understand that there needs to be much more research in this field to better understand until what extent this may impede certain groups to exercise their freedom of speech or to have their privacy or to be treated equally in society. What I know for sure is that there are some ethical guidelines that are trying to frame the development of artificial intelligence, but it is often not that clear when gender and sex considerations are being taken into account. Actually, it is just very recent the attention that the community is putting into this arena, and some of these developments have been focusing on facial recognition and how this affects, for instance, dark skin users and also the female populations, especially because these algorithms are being trained in white male users. So on the one side, it seems that there's not enough research into trying to understand what are the far-reaching implications of these developments. And of course, the law does provide, to a certain extent, several safeguards that could help us in ensuring that these developments are fair and safe to use. The problem oftentimes is that the consequences that this might have for a certain group are often underestimated, are often at a later stage, are often in place once the damage has been done. And we should be really focusing on trying to seek remedies that can anticipate some of these consequences. This is important because there's a vast number of research that is really trying to highlight what are the legal, ethical, and societal implications that technology has for society. So because this research illuminates the implications that this may have, it already shows enough evidence that we should be really looking at these developments from the precautionary principle approach, no?
Yeah, so before we really even are able to do that, and even before we're able to ask if, for example, the legal framework that we have is effective at the moment, we really first need to understand what the implications are. We need to really understand the concepts that we're dealing with, and then we can look at the effectiveness. Otherwise, I take it that's really impossible.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that it is important that we use any mechanism we have already to protect users. If then the technology is pushing the boundaries of the current juridical framework, then it will be a moment when we need to rethink maybe what are the mechanisms that we have, if they are sufficient or not. But we already have a lot of laws and a lot of frameworks because the legal domain works in a sort of horror vacui mode, no, in a horror lacunae mode. We regulate everything since we are born until we die, even after, and we regulate the offline and the online. So there are a lot of provisions that can serve very well into protecting against discrimination. And this could already somehow give the feeling to developers that there is specific safeguards that need to be put in place before we can release these technologies to the wider public.
Yes, that's a very interesting perspective. And also linking back to something you stated before, research has already pointed out that questions around the consequences of automated gender recognition are particularly poorly understood and often underestimated. Now, looking towards the future, how would you suggest to bridge this gap in understanding and estimation among different cultures and stakeholders?
Yeah, there are countless of examples in how technology has been put forward and proposed to solve inadequate engineering practice, government policy failures, and or modern consumerism outcomes. In a way, showing how technological fixes have cultural, ethical, legal, and political implications. Now, automated gender recognition systems may offer a good solution to recognize gender automatically for many applications, but these systems misgender users. And although some researchers are currently working on tools to counter gender bias, and these are really excellent intentions that these propositions have, but they miss the most fundamental aspect of gender that we've discussed in this podcast, that gender is subjective and that gender cannot be objectively recognized. So in Johnston's words, modern problems cannot be reduced to mere engineering solutions over the long term, because human goals are diverse and are constantly changing. So somehow, and based on this premise, on the fact that this technology may try to objectively recognize something that it is inherently subjective, I fear that the only way forward is somehow to ban these systems. Otherwise, we would be always trying to do something that may misgender users that might really hamper the goals that these systems may have. And we might be thinking that, well, yes, of course, from the policy perspective, we can think about whether we can outweigh the risks that such misgendering can pose to society. But we also need to question and to wonder whether we want to be living in a society that it is governed by algorithms that may work for the vast majority of the population, but they risk to exclude really vital parts of the very same society.
So banning the systems, that sounds like quite a radical proposal. And there are also initiatives at the moment, and that's also, I think, a nice point maybe to wrap up. Companies like IBM and Microsoft, for example, have made public commitments to de-bias their technologies, while at the same time, companies like Amazon mounted a public campaign criticizing such research. Now, looking at these developments, what is your view on the argument to integrate gender and sex considerations in the development of algorithms from the start so as to avoid discrimination and the exacerbation of existing biases in the first place?
Better accounting for diversity and inclusion earlier on in the gender target advertising, for instance, or in content suggestion ecosystems could reduce bias in other systems using gender classifier systems, no? So using potentially inaccurate inferences made with bias gender classifier systems, a group of, let's say, for instance, recommendation system may recommend a misgendered lesbian woman to join a male-targeted social network group. So, of course, having a gender classifier system that accounts for diversity and inclusion would help reduce bias in systems in which gender inferences flow, including search and recommendation systems, which is similarly need to be, in a way, fairness aware, no? The problem it is, as what I stated, is that somehow, by accounting for this diversity, the only thing that we are going to do is to help refine these algorithms even more. So if we now can account for male and female, and then we're saying that the gender, it's much more complex, and then we can have more categories on these, then by using these systems, what we're going to be doing, it is actually to provide algorithms that even know way more precisely who you are, which kind of person you are, who do you like, what really defines you. And we see similar developments in the field of emotional AI and the use of emotions in human-robot interaction or in artificial intelligence is hugely problematic because of this. Because emotions cannot be reduced to merely biometrical data. Emotions are really what moves you as a person, what makes you cry, what makes you laugh, what makes you feel as a person. And those emotions are inherently subjective. This is how we all experience life, experience the fact that we are human beings. So if we have algorithms that they are trying to classify us into certain clusters, at some point you're not going to be even able to be yourself, to be even able to one day laugh of joy and another day to laugh because you are terrified.
Yes, exactly. So with these systems, there seems to be an inherent paradox, actually, of trying to objectify something that is inherently subjective, both in the systems that are in gendered algorithms, but also in those that you just mentioned that look at emotions.
Yeah. And then, like, as a society, what we need to to really wonder and to really think about, it is when do we need to stop, right? And don't get me wrong, Hadassah, I am not against technological progress, because part of my research is really about the amazing potential that these technologies, especially assistive robotics, can have for population. Like when I see exoskeletons that help people walk again, or when I see assistive devices that help the blind navigate at home, or that they help someone to be fed when they are eating. These are amazing technology that hold a huge potential for all of us, right? So my vision wouldn't be necessarily to be negative. It would be more about trying to think, what are the priorities that serve best humanity? How we can focus on the development of algorithms and technology that can really help us, that they are really making this society a better place.
That is a really interesting perspective, and actually also quite a positive outlook. And looking at the current developments and statements such as, for example, those made by IBM or Microsoft, it seems that we are heading in the right direction, although we still have a lot of work to do. For now, Eduard, thank you very much for joining me on the show. It was a pleasure to talk to you and hear more from you about this highly relevant topic, and I look forward to seeing more of your work in this area in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, follow the Law of Tech on social media, and receive the Law of Tech's monthly newsletter by subscribing to it through the website www.thelawoftech.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review, as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. You can also support the show by donating to my Patreon, which helps support the running and production of the show. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast. Yeah.